now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti. I thank you for joining us. Now, with me in the studio today, it's the excellent Alison Rudd. And down the line, looking radiant, it's Matt Dickinson. Later on, we'll be talking some video assistant referee type stuff, given some of those wonderful officiating decisions the last couple weeks. Please, no more pausing. But we need to start at the place where the Premier League may have ended this weekend, and that is the Etihad, Pep versus Poch. Dicko, I don't want to be overly dramatic, but, you know, I imagine there were people out there sort of going, you know, help us, Obi-Wan, Pochettino, you're our only hope to actually have a Premier League race this year. And Manchester City just kind of stomped all over Tottenham.
To some people, I guess, you know, beating United, that's it, that's over, and sort of end the title race, sort of yawn. But to me, actually, the way City are playing, the sort of run they're putting together, there's a fascination just in seeing how good they can become. How, you know, can they win every game like this? Can they break records? That's the narrative now, and it's no less interesting to me than a competitive league. Just when you see a team playing in a sort of singular style, yeah, I'm delighted to see it, because Guardiola, you know, brought that reputation. People, as we like to do, question it and pick at it, and he's putting together one hell of a retort in a pretty spectacular way.
Before we praise City, anybody want to find fault with Spurs? Alison? Normally you like to find fault with City, so I'll just give you a chance to question Poch. What could he have done differently? What could he have done better?
I thought this was the crucial game, not the Manchester derby. This was the crucial game. Spurs have the ability to be fearless, and I felt that if a team was going to halt the juggernaut that is City, it would be a fearless one as opposed to a deeply pragmatic one, and it would be more fun if that's the way it came about. And Spurs did have possession, and they had a fearlessness about their lineup and their formation, but their character failed them. They were petrified, and I can only assume that somewhere along the way, the way they were prepared for this game, they went in there. Maybe Pochettino just didn't want them to feel. I don't know. Everyone knows what City are about. So if you're going to go to the Etihad and be brave, they had chances. Spurs. They had possession. They had ideas, and their execution, their final delivery for every pass was shocking. And then they're better. They're much, much better than that. I think probably individually, every Spurs player had one of the worst performances I've seen from them this season. It's hard not to knock Spurs for that sort of collective hysteria of fear. It's contradictory to me that you would go there with an attacking formation and an idea that you could cut a sway through City and expose the occasional lapses in defence that they might have, and yet be so scared of doing it properly. It was probably the most peculiar match I've seen this season, actually.
Dicko, hindsight's always 20/20, but you go up against City when you play Son and Kane and Eriksen and Ali. That's really attacking. Is it the kind of thing where if it works, we praise Poch for his genius outside the box thinking, but because it doesn't, we don't?
Well, I think Alisson's right in some ways. You know, we've seen just about every attempt to unsettle City, and given Tottenham's strengths, I imagine Pochettino thought he was playing to them by trying to do a sort of front foot, you know, very much defend from the front system, try and just, you know, press for those mistakes at the back. But the trouble is, they're hitting a team that, however much pressure you stick them under, they've got a little answer. Which, you know, I don't blame Pochettino for that approach. But yeah, combination of coming up against a team in sort of majestic confidence, as Alison says, the fact that their temperament seemed to sort of get rattled far earlier than the manager can be sort of satisfied with, as has been often discussed. If you're going to try and sort of press collectively from the front, everything has to click right to make that press effective. And ultimately, they sort of tried to set a trap, and City could spring it far too frequently.
I mean, I was asked sort of, you know, how do you stop City? And I don't know, but very broadly speaking, it seems to me that there's two ways, there's two methods that people have used that have worked to some degree. One is parking the bus and then winning the ball back and attacking very directly. That's yielded some level of success, because ultimately, as much as we've praised the development of, and then the improvement of Delph and Stones and Otamendi and these guys, you know, the reality is you have two guys back and you bump the ball over the top and anything can happen. Or the other thing is what Shakhtar Donetsk did at the Etihad in the first half, and Napoli did when they played City as well, which worked for a while, which is, yeah, defend, but when you win the ball, keep the ball, make City chase you, try to play through their press rather than attacking quickly, where you just end up giving the ball back to them, tire them out, pick your spots, and so on. Is this something a better team can do? I mean, is there a team out there that has high quality players and can play that way in the Premier League, or is it, or does it necessarily need to be a team outside the Premier League?
I think Matt mentioned everything's got to click if you're going to be brave against City. I think if Liverpool have 11 players and they're clicking, they're best capable of outscoring City in a match.
That's, how are they going to get... Liverpool can't play out of the back. So you're talking like Liverpool just sitting and... Because the way Liverpool's set up, then it just becomes a slugfest, right?
There's going to be a team that, I don't know, gets ahead, for example, and you've got to get to a point where City start to just lose the sort of the confidence that they've got at the moment, which is, you know, it makes a huge difference, doesn't it? So you need a team, you probably need a team, you know, a decent team that just gets ahead, gets a break, and City then, you know, start to get rattled themselves. I mean, there will come a point in the season, you know, watching them now, it seems, you know, how can it happen, when can it happen, but it will at some stage, where they're chasing the game in a way that they start to get hurried. They start to either overplay or, you know, get in their own sort of, you know, temperamental and tactical difficulties. So I think it's, you know, it's looking for one of those occasions when someone just puts their nose in front and City start struggling to find answers. Say it seems.
City don't score from every corner, do they? It looks like they do sometimes. Okay, so if you make sure you break, you counter attack effectively each time with confidence.
Well, you target Mangala. I mean, Mangala's being made to look like, you know, Beckenbauer, and that can't last, surely. I mean, I just, that may turn out to be...
I was trying to establish a blueprint, and you guys are telling me things like, oh, score first, and then hope that they run out of ideas.
That's a pretty good blueprint.
What's that?
Score more than them.
I know. I mean, is this really where we are? We can't come up with a blueprint that can work. We can't project and imagine somebody who could beat them. I'm talking about, you have to develop a way of playing against them, right? Is there anybody who has any idea other than score first?
Well, it has to be about the team that's most effective in transition, doesn't it? If you've got the ability to be fast and take the chances you get, there is only Liverpool that can do that.
So you're advocating being direct against City?
No, not long ball direct, just...
No, being
breaking,
direct, but counter-attack, breaking quickly.
Breaking quickly against City, yes.
The problem with you, when you break quickly, obviously, you risk losing the ball quickly, and then they just win it back, and then they just come at you again, and then you might not get it again for...
For half an hour.
Exactly,
yeah,
and then you still have Lovren and Klavan back there.
I'm not saying it'll be a clean sheet. I'm not saying Liverpool get a clean sheet.
Dicko?
We need Wimbledon's crazy gang against them, you know, stick them...
Well, no, I
stick it up them. No, I mean, it's
I still think
it's
maybe you guys.
It's a fair question. If it's an answer that eludes Pochettino, I don't think there should be any embarrassment that it might elude us at the moment.
I think I watch every single City Champions League game this season, and I go back to this, and maybe nobody out there remembers the first half against Shakhtar at the Etihad, but maybe you remember some of the of what happened in the Napoli games, and I thought keeping possession and making them chase you, you know, worked for a certain period of time. The problem is I look around Europe and I ask myself, because I don't think anybody in England can play that way. I imagine Real Madrid could probably do that if they so chose. They could try to do it, probably more effective, and they would obviously have the individual quality. But I'm not even sure Barcelona could, frankly. And I can't think of, Bayern certainly couldn't, not now. And that's the thing. Like, it seems to me that it would take either an injury or a drop in form or something like that to derail City. I don't know, I'm at a loss.
Yeah, you're probably right. It needs something to happen to them rather than someone to make it happen to them.
Now, I don't want to pick on referees, but I'm about to. This Craig Pawson, I had an idea of who the good English referees were, right? Like Taylor, who were being pushed and whatever else, and then the veterans. And all of a sudden, this dude like pops up and he does the Merseyside derby and it follows up with this game. And I don't think he's any good. I thought this was a horrendous refereeing performance. I mean, the Otamendi tackle, the Dele Alli on Kevin De Bruyne, the Harry Kane. I mean, am I wrong here, Dicko? Like, thank goodness nothing happened, but we could have seen a bunch of season-ending injuries, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they were... Kane and particularly Ali were lucky to avoid a red card. There's no two ways about it. I mean, he seemed to have a decent view of both. The Ali one in particular. Yeah, that type of movement, that type of connection. Yeah, I think referees are trained to sort of, you know, look out for those, spot them, and should be read without any much argument. So. Yeah, I mean, I've seen enough of him to think he's okay. I don't think he's one of our best, but I've not sort of sat there repeatedly watching Pawson referee and thought.
Do we have any insight? I mean, given this was the biggest game of the weekend and pivotal in the season, do we have any insight on why he was assigned this game and not one of the other guys?
I don't know, not for this particular one. I did actually sit... When I spent, not sure how entirely relevant this is, but I spent a day at St. George's Park with all the top guys, and actually it was Pawson that I sat down with and went through. They just wanted to show me how they analyse a game, and, you know, I don't know if this is any comfort to you, but it was just fascinating that they would go through every single decision, and I imagine these decisions, they flag up some for green, which is, you know, we move on, some for... sort of, I think there's a sort of orange, like a traffic light system, which would be a sort of, you know, were you sure about this? And some that were, you know, red for, you know, you screwed this up. And every single decision is graded and has, you know, those that aren't green have to be looked at. And absolutely, he will be required to do serious homework on this and be asked to explain why he made the decision as he did. Was his positioning right? Did he get a proper view? Why did he think it was yellow cards, not red cards? So, say, whether that makes him a better referee next week, you hope they learn, but it's... He's not allowed just to walk away from it and say, oh, well, you know, job done. He has to answer for those decisions.
And that'll probably be why he was given this match, because you mentioned the Merseyside derby. He was the referee for that, right? Mm-hmm. So he would have been praised for having... the guts to award a penalty at Anfield against Liverpool, and he would have been able to explain why he did it. And I know you disagree with me, Gab, about whether it was a penalty or not, but if he's convinced the people who assess him that he did the right thing and they agree after analysing it, that would have given him masses of bonus points to be able to take on another big match.
I'm just grateful that nobody got hurt and that we didn't, you know, end up with the wrong result because of refereeing errors. I mean, I think hopefully we can all agree on that, yes?
Well, I mean, Ali was punished in a sense because he made Kevin De Bruyne angry, and now we know what an angry Kevin can do.
people waxing lyrical over Ederson's passing from the back? We have a whole spread here, the Ederson distribution masterclass on page 10.
More significantly, he made Lloris look rather average, didn't you think?
Yeah, well, even more significant than that, I kind of think, wow, they have another weapon now, in the sense that that pass to Sterling in the second half, it wasn't just a long and accurate pass. I mean, he absolutely whipped it. It's, you know, so we see goalkeepers sort of punting it out, and the ball hangs in the air, so the defenders have time to come over. But that was pretty outrageous. Is this something he's been doing all year and I just haven't noticed?
A, no one's talking too much about Joe Hart these days. And B, you know, it's all about this back to this confidence thing. If they're seeing a style of play that's developed by your own goalkeeper who can do this stuff, then, you know, that's got to be pretty, you know, if you see him fizzing a ball to your feet as he was doing from the hand, from the ground, then, you know, it's all part of a pattern, isn't it?
And he seems to be, I don't know, I haven't looked at the stats, but he seems to be passing more since John Stones was injured, as if it's deliberate as opposed to just him growing in confidence. It's like he's filling a slight gap there at the back in terms of that composure.
Now this season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you not only get our exceptional content, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, and the FA Cup as well. That's right, the magic of the cup. How about that, coming back in January? Now, just £8 for an 8-week trial. And in the spirit of that, Alison, what was your favourite goal of the weekend in the Premier League?
Without doubt, Mo Salah's goal at Bournemouth, for lots of reasons. But the main one being, it's one of those where you know what's going to happen. I think probably everyone watching TV or in the stadium knew what was going to happen. And you're watching the defence and thinking, no, they can't do anything. Pinpoint accuracy. He scores with joy. He is the player. Maybe him and De Bruyne are the two players completely on form at the moment. And it's lovely watching a player enjoying his football so much and sort of know you're going to get something classy when he digs it out like that. It was just beautiful.
Just to troll Castles a little bit, can you think of something Salah and De Bruyne have in common?
Jose Rijks?
Oh, yeah. Funny
that. Yeah. You can make a team at Chelsea Rijks.
Yeah, I know. But the two best guys in the Premier League?
Yeah,
it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Dicko, your favourite goal of the weekend?
Well, it's probably going to have to be the Ozil volley, isn't it? Although, actually, I was torn because the Corey, he's hit that half volley, which I always love. I mean, I don't want to compare myself, obviously, but a half volley. There's something about hitting a half volley perfectly that I think is sort of feels like football perfection. But I think you have to go with Ozil, don't we? It was a peach of a peach. Yeah, from a player who we often argue about what he does best, where his career is going. Beautiful to see him produce something like that.
Does somebody want to be cynical and point out that Ozil's just kind of turning it on now, just in time for the January transfer window?
And absolutely, he's just turning it on in time for the January transfer window. Arsenal, what are they, you know, it's the fact that the two best players are winding down contracts. Extraordinary, isn't it? It's whatever you think of whatever else has gone on at Arsenal. That is baffling beyond belief.
Moving on to Liverpool, who, of course, won it 5 times. Now, they were playing at Bournemouth. Now, Alison, 2 consecutive draws for Liverpool and that moment when Klopp stopped being sort of funny and mad and became a little bit menacing and whiny, which shows that I think he's only human and he's not switched on all the time. I thought, wow, if they get tripped up here, they could get really derailed. They could get like sucked into the dross behind them and all of a sudden you're wondering about top 4 and all this jazz. That didn't happen. They steamrollered Bournemouth. Were you expecting it?
No, because that seems to be the pattern for Liverpool this season, is that they are frustrated by teams that sit deep and hope to exploit their weakness in defence. They don't terrorise teams the way City do because they have far more weak points than City do. You can frustrate Liverpool and then they get cross and they go away from home and they meet a team in Bournemouth whose morale seems to be quite low. They were very, very sluggish, Bournemouth, incredibly sluggish. I'm not at all sure what their plan was. I mean, Eddie Howe said afterwards he's not going to ditch his philosophy, but it was neither free-flowing, trying to outplay Liverpool, nor defend properly. There was nothing going on. It was very sluggish. And Liverpool had a lot of fun with them. And this is what they do this season. They have a stalemate or a dull draw. They get frustrated in attack, and then suddenly it clicks. But this has happened all season. When Liverpool click, you cannot restrain them. They look amazing and could easily have been 5 or 6 nil, or maybe 5 or 6-1, because Bournemouth did hit the post with Defoe. But yeah, it was a very one-sided game. Unless you were a Liverpool supporter, I don't know that you'd get a lot of fun from watching it, really.
Dicko, did you think that, I mean, it was one-sided, but I looked at those goals in the first half, and, you know, tremendous individual runs by Coutinho and the Salah goal, Lovren anticipating everybody. But part of me also thought, like, why don't these defenders move quicker and kind of anticipate where he's going to go? And maybe, I mean, the Coutinho and the Salah one in particular, I know they're fantastic players, but was that also a case of kind of bad defending too?
I think it was. I mean, Salah won. Everyone knows he's going to try and turn back onto his left foot. That's surely been, you know, drilled into you for the whole time before this game. Or you only have to watch Match of the Day any time for the last few months to know that. And the fact that he's allowed to turn back on it, the fact that he's allowed to sort of drop his shoulder past another couple of players. You know, he's even scoring as he falls over. As Alisson says, they're Bournemouth are sluggish. They seem to make sort of mistakes that you could imagine a decent coach like Eddie Howe has spent enough time in the days running up saying, look, this is what we need to expect. And nothing seemed to go right in countering it.
For some reason, the Coutinho angle seems to have come up again about his future and his transfer. Dicko, is there any actual news on why we think Coutinho might move? I'm assuming it's not going to be in January, right? Why is this a story again? Shouldn't we put it to one side till the end of the season?
Well, it's easy to say. I mean, the fact is, none of us know 100% what's in his mind. None of us know how much contact there may or may not have been sort of off the books, shall we say. We all know it happens. So I guess we all think that, you know, a guy who wants to get what he regards as a sort of dream move to a club like Barcelona is not just going to forget that and just move on and say, oh, well, I'm stuck here for the rest of my life.
Want to move in January and go on.
Well, you wouldn't think so, no. Liverpool are, you know, chasing trophies, chasing top four, and I have to say, unless the money was sort of just, you know, became so ridiculously high that you think, well, we're never going to get that sort of offer again. It doesn't make sense to sell in January. You know, you think if Barcelona want a guy that much, then we hope and maybe we can even create a bigger auction at some stage. So selling in January does not make sense, but I guess, say, none of us think that issue has gone away and there's another window about to open. So I think it's natural to at least ask the question, is it going to flare up again and when?
But it'd be a very weird statement to make to sacrifice Champions League football. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I think it'd be very
the biggest
statement you can make as a player, isn't it?
Look at it from Barcelona's perspective. I mean, unless they lose in the Clásico next Saturday, they're going to go into the winter break 8 points clear, which basically means they don't really need Coutinho to go and win La Liga. They could probably use him to win the Champions League, but he's cup-tied and won't be allowed to play in the Champions League. So Coutinho's going to watch the rest of the Champions League this year on television if he moves to Barcelona. So just to me, this just makes zero sense whatsoever. The summer might be a different issue, but, you know, for now, it just struck me as odd. A word on Bournemouth. We made the point about their defending, and I'm wondering, I'm just going to throw this out there. I always thought the whole thing with Eddie Howe is that they're so well-drilled in the way they moved and off the ball and whatever that they're all better than the sum of their parts. But is this the point where actually there is such a thing of being a talented, athletic, technically gifted footballer? And you know, and then that's an absolute. And if you're not that, if you're Andrew Sermon, if you're Mark Pugh, I want to pick on these guys. If you're Adam Smith, if you're Junior Stanislas, you're not good. And you can kind of only exist in the system where your commitment and repetition and whatever else works. And the minute the system breaks down, you're going to be badly exposed. And that maybe he should have upgraded his player. Maybe he needed more. I know Lewis Cook wasn't good, but Lewis Cook is obviously a very gifted footballer. Maybe he should have, you know, with hindsight, maybe he should have upgraded his players sooner.
But they have for 2 years done what you just explained, which is be bigger than the sum of their parts and be more effective than the sum of their parts. And they did it against Liverpool last season. They proved that if you're resilient and refuse to capitulate, if you go behind, if you stick to your formation and the plan of action, you can beat almost anybody. They're having a poor season. They got off to a poor start. And I think that probably affects all those factors we've just listed. All that self-belief, the belief in the system you have, the belief in the coaching. Once you start thinking too much about how you haven't got world-class players in your team and you're up against them, then you become shaky. That's what they look like. They look like a team that have looked in the mirror and taken away the rosy glow you put on it and seen the harsh light.
Dicko, if this were another club, you wonder if maybe people wouldn't be wondering whether some of this stuff is... some of these guys haven't gone a little bit stale, maybe?
They've stopped rising while maybe standards have around them. And I think, you know, we do have to remember that, you know, Eddie Howe has rightly drawn praise for sort of squeezing pretty much everything he can out of this squad for a couple of years. I mean, you know, I think they're just one of those teams that are sort of, you look at the talent resources and so on, you feel like you're, you know, under good coaching, they're sort of close to giving their all. And that's not an easy thing to maintain, is it? We see plenty of underwhelming teams, underperforming teams around them. And I just think they're a team that was sort of felt like they were being giving sort of 90% of their capacity. And they don't have to drop much for a couple of years. They don't have to drop much below that to be fighting for their lives.
It's a difficult transition to make, isn't it? Like inserting new players into what is a really well-drilled unit, and knowing when to do it, knowing when you've squeezed enough out of somebody that you put him, you know.
What illustrates your point well, I think, you may disagree, and maybe I misunderstand you slightly, is the way that Jack Wilshere, it didn't quite work because he wasn't drilled in it, and they ended up putting him on the bench when he would have been, to most people, their starriest player, their classiest player. Technically, Jack Wilshere's a very gifted player. Sometimes when he was in the team, it was disjointed and it lost its rhythm. And they sort of went back. They reverted to the Eddie Howe Bournemouth way. They didn't want this star extra turn.
But I just think, you know, these guys, unless I'm mistaken, they all get older every year. It's an unfortunate fact of life. And at some point, they're not going to be able to produce the way they did. And even your system, at some point, people are going to look at it, and it's hard to continually innovate. And if you have talented individuals, they can sometimes paper over cracks. If you have less talented individuals who are just kind of cogs in a machine, once the machine breaks down, you're kind of screwed.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, now, in our debate this week, after several, I thought several weeks of a lot of controversial refereeing incidents, I thought we'd talk a little bit about VAR, not least because there's an excellent column in the game this week talking about VAR because it's real. It's here. It's been trialed in Australia, in the United States since in MLS since July, I think, and all season long thus far in Germany, in Italy, and in Portugal. And so we kind of have real live examples of the impact that it's had. And Dicko, I know you've been an early proponent of this, going back to your time in the Dutch truck. I think so far, and feel free, I mean, since I wrote the column, I'll just tell you a little bit what we've found, is that the problems that have arisen, I think, largely in terms of people's expectations, both players and coaches, about what it can and cannot do. There have been issues. There have been technological issues, in especially in Germany. There have been issues of execution in terms of referees still getting used to how things work. But overall, across the board, there have been a significant number of mistakes that would have had an impact on results that have been corrected. We've seen a lot less of players surrounding referees, trying to get them to change their mind, trying to get makeup calls and stuff like that, because, you know, they know that it's all been tracked on video. And we've also seen referees reporting back that, hey, actually, I kind of like this because things go a lot smoother for me, and it's easier for me to go and manage the game when I'm not questioned and I don't have somebody in my ear every 3 seconds. I know you're on board with this. Is this what you expected, Dicko?
The good and the bad of it. I mean, I think there are still issues with the protocol that are still being argued over, quite fundamental issues. I mean, one of them is the, you know, and I've argued it with Mike Riley and David Ellery about this feeling that there should be pitch-side monitors for the system. You know, the actual referee runs over and has his own check, which I think complicates what should be a simpler system where you've just got a guy, you know, in a truck or sitting in a room in the stadium watching the screen, and you trust him to see it and communicate what he sees. But that's one sort of thing that's, you know, the protocol has already been written and rewritten and rewritten and rewritten because they're trying to get, you know, as many glitches out of it as possible. And that's
but Dicko, there's a good reason why Riley and Ellery feel that way, that if the referee has to, when it's not an objective decision like offside, but when it's a subjective decision.
Well, I think there's a good reason that they think that there's a degree of conservatism still, that they want to empower, you know, the referees should still be in power. But I think ultimately referees depend on support. They depend on a linesman flagging and saying, look, I saw something happen, not just an offside, but a foul that was worthy of a red card. I think they depend on that feedback from assistants. That's the point of the assistants. And I think, you know, there needs to build up a point of trust that the video guy tells him, look, you know, you got to take my word on this. This is my decision on this is a red card. And I think it's just part of the fine tuning of the system. But I think overall, you know, it's been what I expected, in the sense that I did a column, there was another VAR controversy, and, you know, I sort of questioned whether football was sort of mature enough to adopt this at all. And I think, you know, even the best possible system of VAR is going to throw up anomalies and sort of grey areas and difficulties. And football, being football, will, you know, jump up and down and throw tantrums and squeal about it. But overall, will it help those guys in the middle who are trying to do an impossible job? Yes, it will, and yes, it must.
Well, it certainly has. What we've seen is that we've had less of them than we've had controversy over wrong decisions and over mistakes. Alison, I think the point that, I mean, and you're a qualified referee here. The reason that referees, I mean, right now, when it's a decision that's subject to interpretation, and again, a reminder, they only review goals, red card situations, penalty kicks, and cases of mistaken identity, which is neither here nor there. But three of those four, there will often be a degree of interpretation and of subjectivity. It's not going to be clear cut. Two different people can look at something and come to different conclusions. And so the belief is that, for continuity, that the referee has to be the one going and looking at it, especially because the way the protocol is written, the rules say that a decision on the pitch can only be overturned if there is, quote unquote, a clear error. So the referee has to agree that he has made a clear error. Does that make sense to you?
Well, I like the fact that there is an awareness that referees can't be undermined. But at the moment, the stage we're at, this mood comes through in your column, Gab, is that it's quite exciting because it's experimental and it's new and we're finding out things about it and we're finding that good things happen, that decisions are made that were the right decisions that might not have been made without the VAR system. But if you have a new drug, a wonder drug, that cures obesity, for example, or diabetes or something, you don't release it on the public until you've tested it for side effects. And we don't, while it's fun at the moment, we don't yet know what the long-term effect of VAR is going to be on refereeing around the world. Because if long-term, it means that referees feel there's an extra burden on them to realise that there is scrutiny. Things they might think are 100% clear to them, they're being told in their ear, actually, do you want to think about that one, sir? Because looking at the monitor, you might be completely wrong. What does that do to your head? And then you have to say, okay, yeah, maybe you're right. I didn't see that left leg take the right leg. But you didn't see it. And then you're having to think on your feet in front of baying crowds about what you did and did not get wrong. Over the years, what effect will that have on football, the flow of football, the way referees feel about wanting to do the job? It might be absolutely miraculous and wonderful and referees might zip into it and it have no side effects at all. But I think at the moment it sounds quite exciting and fun while it's experimental. But when it's out there, I'm worried about how it will impact on... At the moment, to be a referee, you have to be quite an odd individual. You have to be really bolshy and almost sacrificial about it. You get so much abuse without much of the reward. You're sort of infamous rather than famous. People are more likely to pick on you for getting things wrong than praise you when you get things right. The best referees are invisible. We only talked about Paulson in this podcast because he missed a clear red when Dele Alli nearly broke De Bruyne's leg. You have to be a strange person to want to be in that spotlight week in, week out. And I don't know if VAR will make that better or attract the wrong characters to the game. That might be a side effect. It might be you get lazy referees who think it doesn't matter, I can do this and earn an easy wage because I've got VAR to back me up. Just putting it out there.
It's not as if they're going to the VAR monitor every 2 minutes, right? So there's what they call silent checks because the people are watching continually for stuff that might have been missed. But there's the number of calls in the course of a game that are even subjected to or could be affected by VAR are very limited. So you've got the objective ones like the offside where nobody's going to argue because it's like the goal decision system. And the subjective ones, there aren't that many of them in the course of a game. So I don't think the referee necessarily feels under scrutiny that much. And actually he can devote more time to managing the game and ensuring that the game is the game's conducted fairly.
You know, in terms of sort of self-doubt on the pitch or whatever, the fact, you know, they know, you know, from the players' reaction, fans' reaction or whatever, that, you know, there's a sort of howling around them. And, you know, you only have to speak to referees and I've spoken to people at Howard Webb and many others about it, is that they obviously spend the next 10 minutes thinking, oh, God, have I, you know, dropped a nightmare? And they run off at half time, you know, scampering off to speak to whoever to sort of find out, oh, my God, you know, when I gave that penalty in the 13th minute, you know, did I screw up big time? So it's, you know, it's in their minds in any case, and only the very, you know, however good you are, however tough you are, it's pretty hard to get that out of your mind. So I think, you know, the fact that you know from a guy with a monitor, you know, he can say, yeah, you were bang on there, don't worry about it, or he can say, actually, you didn't get a good view on this, we need to overturn your decision. Every referee I've spoken to says this system has to be investigated, has to be introduced. All that we're arguing about is how it's done and the best way to do it. I haven't met a referee yet, professional referee, who says, you know, chuck it in the bin, we don't want it. You know, they've all had different concerns about how it's going to be implemented, but none have said it shouldn't be.
What do you think in 20 years' time will be the impact of having it? Do you think we will have a clutch of referees who are as brave, if you like, as the ones we have now? Or will the profession change?
You know, none of them want to have their decision overturned. Part of the training, you know, absolutely, and they say this explicitly, part of a key challenge of introducing it is still training people to make decisions, because that's, you know, ultimately, you know, it's not the system. It ain't going to work if people are just sort of shrugging their shoulders and thinking, oh, some bloke in the is going to buzz me in a minute and say, you idiot, you know, you missed something. So that you know, that's one of the challenges of implementation, is that there can't be a passing of the buck. You still have to train referees to make decisions. What you're doing is just, you know, and again, Gab's column makes this clear, is that, you know, we are talking about potentially overturning, you know, one, two decisions per game, absolute max. You know, the whole point of it is that it's sort of used in, you know, extreme and only a very few instances. You know, we cannot produce a generation of, you know, buck passing refs. The system will start to break down if that is a result. And I know they're conscious of that and conscious of part of training that can't happen. And ultimately, say, who wants to be a referee who gets it wrong? You know, you're still trained to make decisions and to make the best ones you can.
And also, if you're doing brave decisions, I take you back to Mr. Pawson and Dele Alli. So it's one of two things. Either he didn't see it or he wasn't brave. You know, I, to me, it's pretty cut and dried. I think what we are seeing is we are getting a sense after roughly 1,000 games with VAR about certain things that need to be in place. One, I think the VAR booth has to be in the stadium. I mean, they have to feel like they're part of the team. One of the problems they've had in Germany is that they decided to go and put all the VAR guys in some central command center in Cologne, and the communication with the guy on the pitch hasn't been good. They've actually had stupid technological problems, which you wouldn't expect from Germany. They've also had technological problems with the software that does some of the offsides. There have been mistakes there. And, of course, in Germany, they also had a problem where the guy who was put in charge of it, Helmut Krug, was later sacked for trying to, or removed, I should say, for trying to influence the assistants. I think what's obvious, where it's worked best, is because in the booth you've got two sort of video operators, and you have, usually it's a referee, over the course of a season, rotate the referee so that they're on the pitch one week and in the booth the other week, and really create effectively a team spirit, a spirit of collaboration. It's a real eye-opener when you hear the communication between the two of them, and you really get a sense of how it works. The ball and play time has improved in Italy and in Portugal. I don't know about Germany, although it was pretty high there to begin with. And that is simply because there is less arguing. And I think that's a positive for anybody who likes football, who likes to see actual football played. So despite the delays with waiting for the VAR and the guy walking over to the side of the pitch, overall, over the course of the game, the actual time of football being played has actually increased. Obviously, Infantino wants to have this at the World Cup. They'll be deciding in March. My concern is that because at the World Cup, you've got referees from all over, you're going to have referees with very limited experience with VAR. And I wonder if that could be problematic. We saw it in the Club World Championship, which I know you all followed so closely. But I think it was a Brazilian referee, Sandro Ricci, in the semifinal when Al Jazeera played Real Madrid. There was a Casemiro goal that was disallowed, and he ended up watching it. It just ended up taking it felt like it was ages. And I think part of it is, I don't know who was in the booth, but it didn't look as if they'd had much experience using it. So I think it's still a question mark whether we'll see it in Russia. I personally hope we do, because that is one context where I can deal with games lasting a little longer and waiting a little bit longer for the right decision. How about some quick hits? Manchester United keep pace with City by winning 2-1 at West Brom, but folks are now questioning why Lukaku isn't celebrating and other such nonsense. Allison, why are we so preoccupied with this stupid stuff and Lukaku's goal celebration or lack thereof? Shouldn't we talk about more important things?
Like Brexit. Now, this is the antidote to Brexit, isn't it? Why Lukaku's so subdued. He might not want to celebrate against West Brom, but doesn't explain his previous lack of celebration. Mourinho says it's because he's taking his cue from his grown-up manager and they've decided only celebrate really, really important goals in the last few seconds of the match. It does matter because he looks like a player for whom the criticism has got to him, and you rarely see that in players. They might be off form, but they try not to show that it hurts when people have been saying they're a flat-track bully or not worth a dosh.
Maybe he's just superstitious and has noticed that since he stopped celebrating goals, he started scoring them again.
Could be so many things.
Arsenal overcome Newcastle thanks to a stunning Mesut Ozil volley. And we see Jack Wilshere play well too. Dicko, I bet you'd forgotten all about Jack Wilshere. Is there any chance Arsenal do anything significant this season? Is another false dawn? Is Wilshere's return, quote, like a new signing?
Well, we've got Wilshere who doesn't know what his future is. We've got Ozil who probably does know what his future is, and we can question whether it's anywhere near Arsenal. We've got Sanchez in the same position. So, yes, same old Arsenal, isn't it, really? You see a bit of wonder every now and then, and it comes with a boatload of trouble, doubt, and upheaval and uncertainty.
Wilfried Ndidi dives in a 3-0 defeat to Crystal Palace and gets sent off on his birthday. Alison, he's actually one of my favorite players in the Premier League, and I think he's really good. But do you have any sympathy for the Leicester holding midfielder?
Yeah, no one wants a rubbish birthday. I think, in a way, a lot of good can come from what happened. It's a reminder that he is only 21 and he plays as though he has more experience than that. Also, he's admitted that he did dive. He's not even... I think that's a sign of someone who's mature. He's admitted he made a mistake. And it's one of those high-profile incidents which I think will mean a lot of players will think twice about. This is the whole point, isn't it? It's to make players stop and think, it's not worth diving, actually, I'm going to get banned. So I think, although he had a horrible day, I think it'll make him a better player and will help the game.
Speaking of Palace, Roy Hodgson is finally getting some breaks and a bit of good fortune. And Christian Benteke scores, though he also says he's not sorry for events the previous week when he insisted on taking and missing a penalty, even though he wasn't the designated penalty taker. Dicko, do you understand any of this?
I understand. It's Palace under Roy having an upswing, and it's great, isn't it? I mean, Zahar obviously is a key factor in that. I dared to tweet the other day that it was nice to see Hodgson and Moyes, you know, enjoying certainly a nibble of redemption. And I think they're guys who deserve a bit of a break and an upswing. And I got absolutely battered for suggesting it. Sunderland fans calling me an idiot. Liverpool fans going berserk. So I apologise for saying something mildly nice about two long-standing and in my experience, hard-working, if you know, flawed, but hard-working and possibly even able football coaches.
Marko Arnautović does his best Ibrahimović impression against his old club, and West Ham win at Stoke. Alison, it's looking pretty bad for Sparky. But what do you make of the poor man's Ibrahimović, who plays alongside the poor man's Coutinho, Manuel Lanzini?
I had no idea management was that easy. All you have to do to an overpriced striker who has helped get one manager the sack is to call him into your office and say, you've got to work harder. And apparently that player then turns around and says, OK, we'll do, and then starts looking like he's going to lead the line for you for the rest of the season, make sure you finish well outside the relegation zone and become something of a cult figure overnight. Remarkable.
Do you think it was Moyes who did that, or do you think he got like Stuart Pearce to hide in a closet and jump out and scare him?
No, I'd like to think there is more to it than that, but that's the story they're giving, isn't it?
A Marcos Alonso free kick gives Chelsea all 3 points as Conte leaves Morata on the bench and goes with Hazard, Pedro and Willian up front. Dicko, is this a viable alternative setup, or do you actually need a centre forward long term?
This struck me as the sort of team selection a manager might do if the transfer window is looming and he wants to sort of do a big flashing light over his team and say, I want another striker, give me another striker. The Chelsea won, so all ends well. But I suspect that there is a bit more wrangling to come around Chelsea about transfers, transfer targets, and a manager who, wants money spent.
Gab, I have a question for you. We have a new world champion. Drum roll, it's Real Madrid. Should anyone care beyond VAR?
What does VAR have to do with Real Madrid becoming champions of the world for the sixth time, which I believe is a record? People joke about the FIFA Club World Championship and like, oh, all these rubbish teams in it. But the reality is, it's the champions of Europe playing the champions of every other confederation. And whoever wins can call themselves world champion. Going and belittling it is a little bit like sort of back in the day when English clubs wouldn't play in the European Cup because they thought it was all rubbish and they were the best anyway. No, you got to go through the paces. You have to go and beat these teams. I'll tell you what, Real Madrid played their best lineup. They had a tough time against Al Jazeera because they ran into an outrageously good goalkeeper who saved everything. He looked like something out of a cartoon. And then he got injured, and only then did they win. And in the final against Gremio were terrible, I thought, uber defensive. But even then, the margin was a Cristiano Ronaldo trademark free kick, the 34th of his career, I believe. So no, well done, Real Madrid. They were the best team in the world probably before that. And now they're world champions. And I say we're in the past tense referring to last season. Obviously, City fans, don't get in my back. If you can win the Champions League, and then you'll get your chance. And by the way, you know where they play the Club World Championship?
Bolton, isn't it?
No, not Bolton. Abu Dhabi. So wouldn't it be cool if City win the Champions League and get to go and effectively compete to become world champions on their own home turf?
Be easier for the fans if they did it in Bolton.
Now, it'd be easier for Sheikh Mansour if they did it in Abu Dhabi. I wonder if he'd actually, given he rarely goes to games, I'm sure he'd show up if he was in his back garden, right?
Unless he was having a siesta, yeah.
Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many, many thanks to my excellent guests in this festive season. It's the very festive Alison Rudd and the even festiver... Even more festive, Matt Dickinson. Remember, it's just £8 for an 8-week trial. You get access to all our excellent content, and you can just search The Times online. This season, in addition to our writing, you can access highlights of every game in the Premier League, Champions League, Europa League, and the FA Cup as well. We're going to be back on Christmas Day. Actually, we won't actually be back on Christmas Day. We've actually pre-recorded some podcasts for you to enjoy during the festive season. And I'm going to be here. Alison, you're going to be here. And you know who else is joining us?
Chelsea reject Henry Winter.
Ah, you're referencing Chelsea reject because the two best players in the Premier League this season, Mohamed Salah and Kevin De Bruyne, are both Chelsea rejects. I don't know if Henry Winter is, but he's certainly, to us at least, he's the franchise. He's joining us, and we're going to be issuing our half-term reports for the Premier League season. Have a happy holiday season.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.